Let's go to page 93. How many people have had the experience of sponsoring a prospect that has experience with previous religious experiences or religious teachings or previous 12-step? Maybe they're a veteran of another 12-step program. Raise your hand. Wow, almost everyone in the room. Okay. So this can help us when we notice that a prospect has a little chip on their shoulder around that. I already know this book. I've got X number of years in this other 12-step program. I just need to work the steps for this addiction, right? So Jake, can you read where it says your prospect on page 93?
Your prospect may belong to a religious denomination.
And we can paraphrase that or just internally translate that religious denomination, spiritual center, 12-step, other 12-step group, whatever. They've got baggage from another area.
His religious education and training may be far superior to yours. In that case, he is going to wonder how you can add anything to what he already knows. But he will be curious to learn why his own convictions have not worked and why yours seem to work so well. He may be an example of the truth that faith alone is insufficient. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Let him see that you are not there to instruct him in religion. Admit that he probably knows more about it than you do. But call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink.
You can stop there. And could you reread that last sentence?
Mm-hmm. Admit that he probably knows more about it than you do, but call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink.
So that was the case for me, right? I mentioned before in my share that I had 17 years of I was a 12-step veteran in another program, and I knew this book like the back of my hand. I already knew all the page numbers, where all the stuff was, and everything. And so when one of you sat me down, and we started looking at this book, I was like, yeah, right. I know this part. I just need to get separate from this other addiction. And so him, in a gentle but loving way, just pointed out the fact that if I had applied what is in this book, that him and I probably wouldn't be sitting here today, right? There would be no need for this conversation, right? And it shut me up, right? It made me realize that, and it was a hard pill to swallow, that for all the 17 years in this other fellowship, I had realized perhaps I was not spiritually awakened after all, right? Does someone who's spiritually awakened do the kind of stuff that I was doing at 4 in the morning?
Exactly.
Right? Was I abstinent from drugs and alcohol? Yes. Was I sober? Now let's go to page 24. This kind of helps guide me as a sponsor in the pace at which we go through the steps. Rob, can you read the part in italics? We did read this yesterday, but let's just read it.
The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our own consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink.
So for me, one of my very best defenses was remembering how bad it was, from my last relapse, right? It is a powerful defense, but it has a shelf life, and it is often unreliable. And when you couple that with the fact that I've also got this this mental blank spot that sometimes appears, and I can't really schedule when that happens, there's an urgency, right? When someone asks me to sponsor them, and I'm convinced that he's the real McCoy, his life is now in my hands, right? I mean, existentially, yeah, it's in God's hands, but he's blocked from God, right? Until he gets, you know, until he starts the instruction for step 9. So until he gets there, his life is in my hands, right? So for me to say, yes, I'll sponsor you, but I'm going to be in Hawaii for 2 weeks, so why don't you just call me every day and go to meetings, and then we'll get together. That's my ego, right? Basically wanting me to say, yep, got another sponsee. That makes 6. All right.
Right? Keep a score sheet on which.
Right, keep a score sheet. Look how many sponsees I have, right? So if I know that's going to happen, I say, listen, you know, I'm not going to be around. Let me pass you on to this guy. I can vouch for him, right? There's an urgency related to this stuff. Right, one of my very best mental defenses isn't going to last longer than a week to a month. So I need to get him in touch with a bulletproof 24/7 defense before that other defense runs out. Yes, Jake.
I just wanted to point out in that paragraph because you hear a lot. One of the things I hear a lot with people saying program like, yeah, like I'm so bad at remembering how bad it is, you know, as if, and they say it as if that's just like, oh, this is just some quirk that I have, right? I just have a bad memory. And that's interesting because I would fall into that trap too. And so what I've started to tell people is that, no, actually that is like if you have like diabetes, like sometimes you go into like, your blood sugar spikes, right? Like, that's part of your disease. It's not just like I'm absent-minded. And so I say, like, no, right here it says, like, the fact that you forget is not just like you're some just, like, silly absent-minded person. It is a symptom of the disease that you have. So I think it's important to attack that lazy language and to say, like, you will never have that ability to think again that you are going to, you know, that you'll remember how bad it was. It's always broken.
Yeah. Yeah, as a sponsor, it is my job to work myself out of a job as soon as possible, right? Right, because what this guy really needs is a power that's greater than any human power, that's something that's greater than his addiction. But until we get to step 9, right, I'm standing in the way, right? I need to do everything I can, like I need to remove any block between that newcomer and then the life-giving power of step 12, right? Go, 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 go. Just a reminder, as a sponsor, I'm a human power. Pep talks are great. They're certainly helpful, but even the best pep talk was not going to keep that prospect sober. That honesty, that open-mindedness and willingness, he needs to have that, you know, spilling over the rim long before he meets me as a sponsor. I can't give him that stuff. As a sponsor, I like the analog that was used yesterday. I am a technician, basically there to install software, right? I am not a drama counselor, right? I'm not a therapist. As much as I've done that before. I've been very guilty of being the aspiring therapist, right? Tell me about your mother. being the judge, right? Yes, you did relapse. No, you didn't relapse. Yes, you should make that amend. No, you shouldn't make that amend. Being the philosopher, right? You can always tell a philosopher is the one who's carrying the 12 and 12 before the big book, right? And I love the 12 and 12. Like, Bill is an amazing writer, but it's commentary, right? Mm-hmm. Imagine, you know, pushing someone at an airplane that's flying, and you're 30,000 feet above the ground, and then you push the prospect out, and he's got a parachute on, right? And as he's falling, he's saying, like, what? Help me. What am I supposed to do? And then you say to him, just one day at a time, just 1 foot at a time. It'll be okay. You know, I gave you some commentary on the history of parachuting. It's in your backpack there. You can read that on the way down. What he really needs is something like the big book that says, you pull this lever, you get in this position, and then, you know, the parachute opens and you're good. Like, he needs something, some instruction really quick. For me, it's been helpful to practice my pitch, right? And in the sense that when I'm meeting a prospect or when I'm going to a facility, and the way I personally have done that is attending a lot of foundation meetings, right? So when I work with prospects and eventually they take the 12 steps and we've gone through the traditions, I'll suggest to them, like, why don't you start attending a foundation meetings on a regular basis until you feel comfortable enough to do it yourself? Right? Just something about it just brings a sense of confidence, and it reinforces the facts about myself, right? The physical allergy, the mental obsession, the spiritual malady, and so forth. And also, don't forget the step 11 and the second half of step 12. When a sponsee calls me and they've already taken the 12 steps and they're having a hard time, yes, the first go-to is, do you have someone to help? Absolutely. But not in a vacuum. Right? I also want to know, how's their relationship with God? Tell me about, in the last 24 hours, what you've done with your spiritual devotion. Tell me about your morning meditation. Right? How long was it? Did you time it? You know, what was the quality of it? Did it feel like rote? Did it feel like I just need to get this out of the way? Or did it feel like, what we're trying to do is get you a love affair, like the juicy gossip, you know, the kind of love affair with God that you can gossip about, right? That's the ideal that we're trying to get to. What was your relationship with God this morning? Tell me about your meditation last night, right? And when we retire at night, after we ask those 10 questions, we inquire what corrective measures should be taken. That's meditation. Right? Tell me about what that meditation looked like. If they haven't done those two things, I might not be so quick to say, go find someone to help, right? I'm making sure they're doing both 11 and 12, right? So many of us, we spend a lot of time on 12, but treat 11 like some kind of checklist, right? And it's we relapse anyway. It's like, what happened? I was working with this guy. Well, how was step 11? And we can always use our sponsors. My go-to responses when a sponsee calls me, again, a sponsee that has already taken all 12 steps and they've got some kind of life problem, my first two go-to responses are, I don't know, let me get back to you, I'm going to talk with my sponsor, and how's your relationship with God? And we'll go through that. You know, tell me about, what was your morning meditation like this morning? What was your evening meditation like yesterday evening, not 3 days ago? Are you making progress on your ninth step? You know, what date are you going? Do you have that you're going to finish all your ninth step amends? Are you clean on 10? What are you doing on 12? Right? How's your relationship? Basically, trying to, because if I just ask them how is your relationship with God and they say it's good, right? You know what that means. So we ask them, like, you know, for us in 12 step, our relationship with God, it's not a feeling, it's an experience. My relationship with God is the sum of the actions that I've taken on 10, 11, 12 in the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And then for me personally, the kind of sponsorship, the places that I do it, ISO has a great program called the Prisoner Outreach Program. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, you can talk with one of us after the meeting. I sponsor a number of prisoners. And have I ever found a prisoner that goes through all the 12 steps? For me personally, never, right? I've gone through maybe 80 prisoners, right? Not a single one has made it through all 12 steps. They give up somewhere along the way. I'd say about 99% of them give up after my first response, right? Because I'm there to say I am not a pen pal. A lot of them write because they think they need a pen pal. I am not here for you to dump your sexual history on me in your second letter, right? And I basically tell them what I am here for and what I'm not. But the letters that I get from prisoners that show up in my mailbox, they have saved my butt more than once. When I come home from work or a hard day and my mind is going in the wrong direction and I open the mailbox, here's a bill from PG&E and a bill from AT&T and, oh, it's a letter from Harry down at the state prison. I have to respond to this letter in the next 48 hours, so let's get busy, right? And that takes a while to write a letter. And by the time I finish that letter every single time, it's like, why was I thinking about acting out, right? So whether or not Harry writes back to me or does this thing, I wrote to him. It's kind of cool. ISO also has a men's outreach list. For people that are looking for sponsors throughout the world, that nets me maybe one or two guys a month. You know, I'll get a call from them. Most of them don't pan out. But again, you know, it's not my business to know what happens with them. I'm just here to carry the message, let them know.
What was the, I missed the important part of that. Where were you carrying the message to?
The last place, it's called the Men's Outreach List. Okay. Am I getting the name of that thing right? The Men's Outreach List?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. That is also through ISO. So it means that a lot of the prospects that you'll be getting are people who might already be exposed to kind of a Green Book approach, but it's there.
Go ahead, keep going.
And then my sponsor introduced me something. Basically, it's 3 in the morning, right? And I'm having a hard time, right? No one's answering their phone because it's 3 in the morning, right? I can't call my prospects. I can't go to facility because it's 3 in the morning. What do I do? Right? Well, just like Big Book says, the problem is self. The solution is getting out of self. So if I can't find a sex addict at 3 in the morning to work with one-on-one, we call it a go-to place, right? So this is basically, and you get to make up what your own go-to place is. For me, I grab a hefty bag and a flashlight, and I go to a place outside of my neighborhood so I don't benefit from the work I'm about to do personally. And I basically pick up litter, right? But it's not my own neighborhood, so I can't benefit. Like, I don't get a cleaner neighborhood. It's someone else's neighborhood. And I do that, and I don't get caught. I don't want anyone else to see that I'm doing a good thing, right? Or come home and being asked, well, where were you? It's like, I was picking up garbage. Like, I don't tell anyone, right? My ego would love for people to know. It's my go-to place. Other people, they'll grab some peanut butter and jelly and some bread from the pantry, and they'll make a few sandwiches, and they'll go down and look for people on the street and pass out sandwiches. Whatever it is, you get to make up your own go-to place. It's not a substitute for 12-step work, but at 3 in the morning when I can't find anyone to do 12-step work with, I can go help, right? Our go-to place. All right, trick question. Is meeting attendance part of the 12-step program?
No.
It's not?
Nope.
90 meetings in 90 days?
Nope.
Meeting makers make it?
Nope.
When you're having a hard time, go to a meeting?
Nope.
If you don't like meetings, you're not going to enough meetings?
Nope.
What happens to people who don't go to meetings? Well, you go to meetings to find out what happens to people who don't go to meetings.
Well, meeting your sponsor is technically a meeting.
That's true, yeah. Maybe we can put, that's a good qualifier. So that one-on-one, you know, work with my sponsor going through the steps, or me as a sponsor working through them, yeah, that's great. But the actual, let's have a meeting and we're going to talk. Today's topic is acceptance or whatever it is.
Relationships.
We'll talk about relationships, right? Or we go to meetings and we find out that so-and-so relapsed. And then we all conclude, well, he wasn't going to enough meetings. Right? Imagine someone who has diabetes and that person has a seizure and dies. And then the doctors gather around. Do you think the first question they're going to be asking is, how many diabetic support group meetings was he going to that week? What's the first question they're going to ask? Did he take his insulin? Was there a sufficient amount of insulin in his bloodstream? For us, that insulin is a spiritual awakening, right? And we have a very explicit set of actions that result in that spiritual awakening. So when we ask that question, when someone relapses, well, how many meetings were you going to? We reinforce this myth that meetings have something to do with whether or not I stay sober. Does the book talk about meetings?
One place.
Yeah,
yes.
I can.
Over in A Vision for You, they talk about we set aside one night a week for newcomers for a place they might bring their problem.
Yeah, the book does mention meetings. And they loved them. They really liked their gatherings. Bobby, you were going to say something.
No, I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah. So let's go to page 159. Yeah, the big book is not anti-meeting. They just had a different context for it. So we're going to kind of skip back to the middle of it. Let's see. So this is after there's it's Bill, it's Bob, and it's the third guy, Bill Dodson, and then they get thanks. What's that?
Devil May Care.
The Devil May Care. Yeah, they've got a few more, and then they slowly developed a set of people. If Jim, can you start reading on page 159 where it says a year and 6 months later?
A year and 6 months later, these three had succeeded with seven more. Seeing much of each other, scarce an evening passed that someone's home did not shelter a little gathering of men and women, happy in their release and constantly thinking of how they might present their discovery to some newcomer. In addition to these casual get-togethers, it became customary to set apart one night a week for a meeting to be attended by anyone or everyone interested in a spiritual way of life. Aside from fellowship and sociability, the prime object was to provide a time and place where new people might bring their problems.
Thank you. A time and place where new people might bring their problems. Does it mean that we're going to allow them to talk about their problems and focus on the problems, but bring it, right? And when you showed up, we see that you're new, and two of us, what they would do is two or three of the regulars would take you right back out, either to the kitchen or to the attic, and we would ask about you. Tell us about your drinking, all right? Here's our solution. Are you open to that, okay? Here's the actions we took to get that solution. Are you open to that, okay? Let's get on your knees, and we'll make a decision. Here's a little bit of instruction. Let's go back into the room.
So it also, the preceding part, to me, implies, as far as the other guy, I mean, they were meeting together almost every night, but it says, constantly thinking how they might present the discovery to some newcomer. So they were sitting there making plans. Where do we find the next guy? Where do we look?
Right.
How do we approach them? That's what they were using their meeting time for.
Yeah, they were making it their business. Yeah. They knew it was their business. How are we going to perform God's work well? They would talk about, well, you said this thing about the sauerkraut and the concoction they would use to lessen the hangover. Mm-hmm. And that killed someone. Maybe we shouldn't do that again. But they would just figure out what's working and what's not. They would always be doing that. They'd get together. How can we make our message more effective? I'm going to mention my experience with starting a group. So, you know, I met you guys. I was on fire. I was like, oh, my God. And then I went back to my fellowship in my area, and I looked at all these meetings. There are about 75 meetings probably in the Bay Area, different S-related fellowships. And I looked around, and I was like, oh, these poor son of a bitches. if they just knew what I know now, right? And so I made it my business to go about and fix them, right? And what that looked like is going into these meetings, and people would share in the manner that the only way that they know how, and they would share well intentioned, like they mean well, and then I would give a counter message. I'd always give a counter message. I'd always disparage their approach. And I'd say it in subtle ways sometimes not so subtle. And after a few of those meetings, they started to do this whenever I would come sit by them. Right? And after fellowship, they were all talking with each other, but none of them were interested in talking with me. Ironically, you know, this idea I had that I'm going to help them, I was having the opposite effect. My sponsor called me on it. He said, perhaps that is misguided spiritual thirst. Right? No doubt I had a spiritual thirst. I wanted to help, but I was doing it in a misguided way. When I was showing up at these meetings and I was speaking this counter message, right, I was breaking every single time traditions 1, traditions 2, and traditions 4. Right? Tradition 1 talks about unity. You need to make sure that, and it's not the kumbaya kind of unity. It's that, are we unified on what the problem is, what the solution is, and what the nature and the path to that solution is? And these other meetings had different ideas about that than I did, right? And so when I went in there, I was basically an agent of division. I was not an agent of unity, right? Tradition two, right, talks about the group conscience, that coming from God. For me to speak a counter message in these other groups was basically second-guessing God's work in that meeting, right? God is everything, or God is nothing. We learned that yesterday when we were talking about step two. God is that meeting, right? God created that meeting. There is a reason for that meeting to exist and to carry the message that it does. It may not work for me, and it's not my business to know whether or not it's working for others, right? But for me to try and fix it is me doubting God's business. I was getting in the way. I was doubting how God expressed himself in that group conscience, right? And then tradition four. Basically, another way of looking at tradition four is every group has the right to be wrong, right? Now, for me to think that I'm right and they're wrong, which was the way that I was going into this, right, and basically disparaging them both in the meeting and then outside of the meeting, like, don't go to that meeting, right? I'm breaking tradition four when I do that. So that was my first attempt. It didn't work.
What other effect did it have?
I basically burned all my bridges, right? So all the potential ways of, you know, networking is important. Like, in order for me to find prospects, it's really important for me to be on good terms with as many people who might have access to people who are desperately drowning as possible, including people in more conventional SAA meetings, right? And I burned all those bridges, right? I shouldn't say all of them, most of them. So if I were to go into a conventional SAA meeting today in my area, they know how I used to talk. I don't talk like that anymore. For the most part, I don't even attend those meetings anymore. But when I do, like, they remember, and so they're still very standoffish, and they don't call me anymore. And when I call them, they don't return my phone calls, right? I'm alone in my fellowship. In the Bay Area, 60 to 70 meetings, face to face, no one to talk to, except Steve. Steve, who was put in my life just about 2 months ago. So it turns out we live in the same area. His sponsor is Jake. So together we'll work on stuff.
Thank God.
Yeah, thank God. But before I met Steve, my second attempt in starting a group was. I went around with Green Book people, and I had plenty of friends. They're good people, right? And some of them, as I hope I won't get tarred and feathered for saying this, but some of them, right, they are free from their sex addiction. They just did it in a different way, a way that didn't work for me, but worked for them. And I would make friends with them. And I asked a handful of them, like the people that had taken the steps and their approach, like, let's start a meeting. There's this great, you know, primary purpose group study guide. Let's use this. They looked at it. They said, wow, this is amazing. Inside, what's really going on with them, though, is I need to make a certain number of meetings per week, and this is going to spice up the format, right? So we did. We started a meeting, right? And it was really popular. And it's still popular. But what happened after about 3 months of that, well, I should say, as we would read the big book in the meetings, what you start hearing a lot is, well, the big book says this, but we don't really do this anymore because it was written back in the 1930s. Just every suggestion that was in the book, there would be some kind of compromise, right? So we'd read the book, but in between meetings, no one was actually practicing what the book said. We'd all go back to other literature. So it was basically, it was a shell of a meeting. It was a shell of a kind of a primary purpose approach. I think about a year into it, the group conscience decided to continue studying, but let's study a different piece of literature instead, one that was more popular with an SAA. So that was my first attempt. My second attempt was I worked on for a corporation on one side of the highway, and I had a Tuesday meeting slot that was open, right? I had not yet recovered from meeting maker-ism, right? The like this programming that was set in my head for the previous 17 years. So I was still in this thing like meeting, got to find a meeting, got to start a meeting, right? And so I said Tuesday at lunch, right across the street is a church. Talked with the church, you know, figured out a lease, but I didn't have anyone to start it with. So I picked one other guy that I was sponsoring at the time. So the two of us started this meeting, published it in the local schedule. And as soon as you publish a meeting in the schedule, there's a lot of meeting makers out there. Zoom, right? Everyone shows up. Tuesday at lunch. Awesome, right? We don't know who these people are. It's just myself and this other guy with 10 other guys who are taking a completely different approach. What do you think the content, the message of that meeting was?
Confusing,
yeah. Different approaches, right? This guy uses therapy. This guy uses 90 meetings in 90 days. This guy uses, you know, whatever. Like, imagine drowning in a pool, and you got five different lifeguards trying to save you in five different ways. Right? So that is today one of the most miserable meetings that I've ever been to, because it's even worse than just a regular meeting, because now they've got the big book, and they're so miserable with it. So what I learned there was, by the way, to the people in the Dallas Group's credit, you were warning me long before this, like, please don't start a meeting. That's not how we do it. We don't like find a building and then publish it in the schedule. I'll say in a minute what is suggested, but don't do it that way. So that was my third attempt. So now, what's going on now is, I should say, leading up to then, I continued to do the facility work. The first place I went to was the Henry Olaf House, which is not closed, but it was across the street. Myself and a sponsee, we dressed up, and we made an appointment with the manager, and we sat down with him, and we practiced our pitch before we went. He said, "This is who we are. We'd like to, you know, we're just another resource in this community. We have this particular problem. We found a solution. Do you think that we could be of help? We certainly don't want to get in the way of how you're doing things here, but, you know," and basically he looked at me and said, "Man, we have been waiting for you guys for 20 years. Right? You don't understand. All of our clients here, like every three weeks, we have to whitewash the computers because they're just filled with porn. Right? Where have you guys been?" A quarter of a mile down the street was the largest SAA meeting in the area, right? That had been going on for 20 years. They didn't know about each other, right? I just took one guy or two guys to go there and say, "This is who we are. This is what we do. How can we help?" Right? They're closed now, but we did have several meetings with them and their clients. Did any of the Pied Piper thing with sponsees coming out of the building with us happen? No, never. Did the two of us walk out of that meeting high on life every single time? Absolutely. Was it the thing that we looked forward to every Sunday afternoon? Absolutely. It was amazing. Went to the county jail. Spent a year and a half working with the rehab coordinator there on how to make this work. Finally, she said yes. I got about five or six other guys. We sent our background checks like you have to do for jail and stuff like that. And we were all ready to go, and then she went to the board of the jail and said, "We want to have this meeting," and they said no. Right? So I want to bring that up because sometimes all these negotiations and these attempts to try and carry our message in the facility, it fails, but we try anyway. Yes, Ken?
Did you stay sober while you were in
it? I stayed sober while I was doing that, yeah. And perhaps a side effect of that I got good at how to communicate with people, especially the rehab management in jail, is the next county jail, which was unfortunately 2 hours south of us, I got was better at my pitch. And so the very first call, it was just a cold call. I just called the guy in San Bruno County Jail and gave the pitch. And within 5 minutes, he said, "Yeah, let's do it." Right, and so unlike the year and a half of this other jail, you know, the second jail said, "Yeah, come right in." We did a background check, so within a month, there were six of us going in there, and speaking to a sea of orange jumpsuits, about 50 guys, right, with SAA. That too We did that for about 2 years, and that fell apart mainly because the rehab manager left. And with him was basically our number one ally in this. And so when the new rehab manager came in, she was not on board with this. And so we've, as of recently, we lost that. I also have gone to a John school. So for those that aren't familiar, this is another opportunity. A John school is a basic little place, just like traffic school. You get busted for soliciting prostitutes. Some communities give you the option of you can go to jail, or you can, you know, spend 8 hours being lectured at and pay this amount of money. And most people take the second route. I want to be lectured at for 8 hours. And so we would come in for one of those hours and basically be the breath of fresh air because we would lecture, right? And basically say, this is who we are, this is what we do, here's how to contact us, right? Did any of them reach out to us afterwards? Two of them did. Did they pan out? No. The NSD server? Yes.
Were you also happy while you were sober?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, what I've learned is first I had to break that meeting maker mindset. It's still in me, right? I'm still doing the deprogramming thing, right? I'm grateful to one guy who basically said, Brian, for the love of God, stop going to meetings and start carrying the message, right? It may mean that I go to a meeting, but I'm there for a very specific purpose, and it's not to fix them. So for me, there's three reasons to go to a meeting. One is before I have a solution, meetings, particularly a meeting, solution-oriented meeting, it's a place where I get to see it working in others, right? Page 25, I think, talks about that, right? So I'm basically seeing a group of recovered guys, it really helps. And it's where I can find a sponsor as well. That's the second reason is after I've awakened, I've taken the toolkit, is I get to be the one in whom it is working, right? The new guy sees. And then the third reason is, basically I'm somewhere in between. I don't yet have a solution, but I'm not yet awakened. If I'm showing up at a meeting, why? Hopefully my sponsor is going to help course correct me there, right? Our solution is not meeting attendance. Our path to the solution is not meeting attendance. You've been given clear instructions on your fourth step. Do you have any questions? Do you have ink in your pen? Great. There's no need for you to go to a meeting. Just call me when you're done with that. So that third reason for going to a meeting, if I don't have a solution, but don't you have a spiritual awakening, why are you here? Why are you in a meeting? Right? You've got work to do. Right? You're in a burning building. Are you going to gather the other victims in the building and talk about how the smoke is choking you? Right? Not yet. Let's get out of the building, and then we'll talk.
So, there's not a fourth reason, dumping a 10-step in a meeting?
Dumping a 10-step in a meeting. I haven't tried that yet.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Does it work out?
No.
It doesn't work out.
Brian?
Yeah.
Part of what you're saying, that one of the what I've always said is, I go to meetings to meet protégés or potential protégés to do service and have an opportunity for sure. And I hope I'm not... Were you trying to say, and you're learning the message better when you go to the meetings?
Actually, you know, that's a good point that I may have missed. So I'll also go to, like, I'll go to my home group.
Yeah.
So I can, with other recovered folks, we'll study how to better carry the message. Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay.
Yeah.
So can you repeat the reasons you go to the meeting?
So the first is, before I have a solution, to see it working in others, and to find one of those guys to take me through the steps. That's a good reason. The second is, I've taken the toolkit, I've awakened, and now I'm on the other side of that. I get to be one of those in whom it's working and perhaps be picked. And then the third reason is a bit iffy. I don't have a solution, but I don't yet have that awakening. I'm somewhere between steps 4 through 9, between steps 4 through 9. It's actually not a reason, it's an anti-reason. Hopefully, for me, if I see a sponsee somewhere between steps 4 through 9, show up at a meeting, it's either because they ran out of ink on the fourth step, or because they need clarification or something, right? Or maybe there's some logistic that says, you know, we can't meet each other for a day and a half, so okay, right, they've done their work. And then, and as Matt pointed out, to I guess the fourth reason would be to get together and study the message. I don't go to meetings to kill time. I don't go to meetings to go to meetings. I don't go to meetings so I can hit my quota. Meeting attendance has nothing, it just factors nothing into my sobriety. What happens in between meetings, everything. Let's go to tradition 5, the long form. It's on page 5, 60... Is it 3 or 4?
563.
Depends on if
you have a fourth or a third edition.
Yeah. And then Steve from...
Here I am?
Yeah. If you could read the long form of Tradition 5.
Each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity, having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers.
Spiritual entity. So the long form uses that phrase, spiritual entity. So before I can basically announce to the world that we've got a group, and you know, newcomers are welcome to come in. Anyone that's interested can come in. I need to make sure that that my group is a spiritual entity. In other words, each of the members of my group have had a spiritual awakening. If I start a group where a majority of us have not yet taken the steps, we're not yet spiritually awakened, what kind of message are we going to carry? Yeah, likely a sick message.
My mind, my thoughts, my theories, my ideas, they're me.
Me, me, me.
Me, me.
So in creating this group, we can look at the model that they describe in this book. Bill goes to Bob. Now it's Bill and Bob. Bill and Bob go to Bill Dodson. Now it's Bill, Bob, and Bill. Bill, Bob, and Bill go to the fourth guy. Now it's the four of them. Before they go to the fifth guy. Now they've got somewhat of a quorum. Guys who are all on the same page about what the problem is, what the solution is, what the path of that solution is, right? They've met tradition one. They're unified on this thing. Right? And then that second tradition, right? Basically, what's our decision policy going to be? Well, they decided that in their personal lives, so it makes it pretty obvious what it's going to be like in their group life. God. God's going to be the ultimate decision maker. Right, so now they've got two of the four ingredients necessary to have a powerful message. That third tradition, right, now this was a bit iffy in the early days because they had a lot of it was unfortunately fear-based, so they had different requirements. But eventually, they realized that the only requirement is a desire to stop acting out, or for them, a desire to stop drinking, right? And then that fourth tradition, making sure that each group is autonomous, that we get to make our own business as long as we're not adversely affecting the groups around us. Right? So we've got those four ingredients. When you put those four together, you get a powerful message. Right? You can apply that to a corporation, to a business, to a small business. That message, as a result of those first four traditions, brings out a powerful, basically a fifth tradition. Your group now has a purpose. Once you've got a quorum of guys, then you can open it up. You can open the doors up for other people. So when two or three new guys come in or from a different message, you've got four or five other guys to set the tone, right? Your message is less likely to be changed or modified. So I'm going to close with some statistics. Most of us... Most sex addicts... don't make it, right? We never get to the point. Most people who have sex addiction, they die from this thing, never even getting to a place where they want to stop. A fraction of those people who are about to die from this thing, something in them says, this isn't right, I want to stop. Of that fraction, only a fraction of those people who want to stop ever find a solution, right? Of those people who find a solution, only a fraction of them pick up and apply that solution. Of those people who apply that solution, only a fraction of them apply the 12th part of it, right? That they're working with others, right? So you, sitting here, you are an anomaly, a statistical anomaly, right? You've been given a gift from God. You have the power to help the sex addict in a way that no one else can help. Don't waste it. We need you. Thank you.